You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today we are in Cuenca.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freib.
Hello.
And Fran Reyes.
Hello, chaps.
And the familiar question, well, I should say before we go to the familiar
question.
Where is Lionel? Where is Lionel?
Watford.
Watford. Of course he's in Watford. He's back. He's left us to continue his holiday in Watford, I think. But we were played in there by the sound of Fran at the finish. Quite a twist at today's stage. You were waiting with Jetse Ball and his manager, I think, at the finish, waiting to see whether he unexpectedly had the red jersey of race leader.
Exactly. We could hear there Adrián Palomares counting the seconds. Adrián Palomares is the current master of Manzana Postobon. And you know which race he won in 2008?
Oh, here we go again. No.
Come on, you should know.
The Tour, Tour of Portugal. Ah!
The Tour of Britain,
Canarias, the latest iteration of Vicente Velda's team.
Sorry.
Fran, I don't know much about Manzana Postobon.
I thought you were going to say you don't know much about
cycling. No. I know, but the other day I discovered what Postobon is because I had some Postobon grape juice in the press room.
Yeah.
It's tremendous.
Yeah, Postobon's been around in cycling for years.
Yeah, but I'd forgotten. So that's a supermarket?
No, Postobon is one of the biggest soft drinks companies in Colombia. You know, they indeed appertain to a bigger company called RCN that is a giant media empire there.
Well, listen, a lot of people will be wondering how a Dutchman, Jetse Ball, ends up on a tiny Colombian team. And we will actually hear that story later in this episode because Fran spoke to him a few days ago about that. So we'll hear an interview with Jetse Ball a little bit later on in part two, I think. But where are we, Fran?
Well, we are in the beautiful city of Cuenca, one of the, as I perceive them as a Spanish, is one of the dullest cities in the whole country.
But yeah. It's one of the most beautiful places in Spain, hands down. Going to Cuenca and finishing where we finished today at the bottom of the town on a completely anonymous street, it reminds me of the time that I interviewed Marcel Kittel at the Arctic race and he was wearing a cap. So I didn't get to see his magnificent hair. We went to Cuenca today and we didn't see the magnificent old town. Yeah, truly one of the jewels of Spain, come on.
Yeah, it's tiny, doesn't have a huge university,
There's no Movida, the dance floors are small, I know that, Fran, but it is beautiful.
I tell you what, it's the drives sort of inland, it's in the middle of nothing. I mean,
It's La Mancha.
Yeah.
One of the main characters of the Spanish literature is Don Quixote. Okay, so Don Quixote got really crazy. And do you know why? Because he was from La Mancha and there is nothing to see in La Mancha.
But it's very beguiling. It's kind of inspiring.
It's kind of beautiful. It's kind of
inspiring.
Bleak and beautiful. Very arid. And it's also Luis Ocaña.
I was
going
to say, not for very long though. What age was he when he moved to France? He was 10 or 11, 12 when Luis Ocaña moved to France. He spent most of his formative years in France, I think.
Anyway, in the absence of Lionel, Fran, can you give us... I've passed over this responsibility. Can you give us the tale of the tapas, please?
Yeah, I first was meant to fill in for François Thomasson. Now I am meant to fill in for Lionel Verne.
These are big shoes to fill.
Yeah, I'm afraid that tomorrow I'm going to do the podcast alone.
Big clothes to fill. Maybe not big shoes. Sorry, Lionel.
Well, so the seventh stage of this Vuelta a España from Giria in the inlands of Valencia to Cuenca, right in the middle of La Mancha. It was a quite flat stage and with a lumpy finish. Breakaway took a bit to be confirmed because Team Sky didn't want a big group with meaningful riders for the GC to get away. Finally, a 14-man breakaway was established. Among those, we had usual suspects such as Jetse Ball, Alexis Goujard, or Pavel Podianski, the guy who was second yesterday in Puerto de Sagunto, and I think we will hear of him later. Matej Mohoric, Slovenian rider for UAE Emirates, was the one to get away with the victory. When they reached the decisive part, which was the climb up to the Alto del Castillo in the center of Cuenca, a nice cobbled hill, Matej Mohoric took the responsibility to trim the group and reach the top of the climb with another three riders, José Joaquín Rojas from Movistar, Thomas Degent from Lotto Soudal, and the aforementioned Paul Jansky. Right after the summit, he took advantage of a tiny gap that was formed, maybe a 10-meter gap, no more, and rode away in impressive fashions as the rest of the breakaway companions looked at each other, hesitating. Matej Mohoric sealed the victory, Pavel Poljanski coming in second, and Jose Joaquin Rojas taking the third position. Meanwhile, in the bunch, there was not much history, only a bit of tension because of crosswinds that led to some crashes that took out of the race two of our Pedalier de Charm contenders, Marawi Kudus and Larry Warbes. I don't know if you guys have anything to say, but for me, it clears the path for a victory in that contest for Jack Haig.
I think you can still win it, even if you're not... I mean, Larry Warbes, a very resounding victor. I'm actually... A Pedal de Charm t-shirt is actually winging its way to the hospital where he is at the moment. So we're.
I always refer to him as Lucky Larry, but he was a bit unlucky today, wasn't he? But lucky if he's stolen the Pedal de Charm.
No, not sure it's stolen.
Well, not literally.
It's a democratic vote. I mean, he did get the support of some real big beasts, as I said. I mean, Andy Hood, Theo Gegenhart, Kaylee Fretz, they all weighed in for Larry. So he was a very, very... perhaps the most convincing winner ever of Pedaleur de Charme. Is that the tale finished, Fran?
I think you keep interrupting me.
I'm sorry.
Because it was ad-libbed. Did you notice that?
It was very impressive.
It was like being at the podcasting equivalent of a rap battle. It was like 8 Mile for podcasts. It was incredible.
A real...
Yeah.
You can rap it. You can sing it. You can put it to a Beatles tune in future episodes, I think.
Yeah, I will get back to that. I mean,
We can work on that.
Very unconvincing impersonation of Lionel there, wasn't it? Because it was far too factually accurate.
Oh, yeah.
So far, don't worry. I will make up a Chris Froome attack now.
on that note, we should say that there was a bit of an error last night. My fault, actually. I have to take responsibility for this. It would be great to blame Lionel now that he's no longer here. But I'd told Lionel beforehand that Gianni Moscon missed the Italian Championships due to his suspension from racing. In fact, he came back. His suspension ended just before the national championships, and he did win the Italian time trial. He did ride the team time trial the night on a special bike and all the rest of it. So should have known that. Bit of an error. Sorry about that. But, you know, just continuing the 60% accuracy.
Yeah.
The bar is set very low. Sorry, Fran.
Yeah. Anyway, the bunch reached the bottom of this Alto del Castillo climb together. It pretty much nothing happened because Sana rider tried to pull and create some confusion, but... in the end, a 40-man strong group get to the top of the climb and they peacefully reach the finish line. So Chris Froome keeps the leadership of the GC, Davide Villela keeps the mountain classification, and Matteo Trentin, the points one.
So peacefully, in fact, that Chris Froome was asked in his press conference tonight whether he admired some of the scenery, some of the landscapes, whether he ever got a chance to look left and right, you know, or remove his gaze from his stem, which he's constantly looking out and taking some of the surroundings. He said, indeed, he does sometimes, which, you know, I thought was nice to hear. We used to get that question in the early days of Lance Armstrong's domination at the Tour de France. I remember American journalists were very fond of asking him that, whether it was a big part of his Tour de France experience taking in the rolling hills of Provence. And
well, it was towards the end really beautiful. I mean, we saw an unfortunate incident on the cobbled climb with a motorbike taking out Rafael Race. We saw a motorbike taking out Rafael Race. We'll hear from him in part two. I couldn't really take my eyes off the screen and the sight of Mohoric descending to the finish. I remember him doing that in 2013 at the World Championships in Florence. He won the junior world title 1 year and then the under 23 world title the following year. And I remember he appeared in the press conference. He was a very, very articulate young guy. I think he was 19 at the time. And I think a lot of people thought this guy is the next big thing. You know, he looked to have it all. And it's taken him a good few years to really find his feet in professional cycling. He's been around a bit. He was on the Cannondale team for a bit, wasn't he? And he's joining Bahrain next year, but this is his best performance, best win as a pro, isn't it?
Yeah, and he has been a pro for a very long time now. Well, this is his fourth pro season, isn't it? And he's almost been kind of written off as a faded prodigy or someone who has not really lived up to expectations, and that's overlooked the fact that he's only still 22 and has slowly come into his own over the past couple of years. He rode a very good Giro last year, I remember, and You mentioned a descending technique, Rich. I asked him about this at the finish, and he was very responsible. It was like a public health message. He said, yes, I do it sometimes, but you know, people watching at home mustn't adopt this style too often. I only use it in extreme circumstances, like today when I wanted to or I needed to
win.
Exactly. But he did, I think it's fair to say that he did pioneer that technique in professional cycling. It's been credited to Michał Kwiatkowski, Chris Froome, but I think Mohoric got there first.
Peter Sagan as well has done it, hasn't it? We've seen him descend like that.
He's come up with a good name for it. It's kind of like the...
Yeah, I mean, I pointed out on Twitter, it's a very position very similar to the one that Graham O'Bree adopted back in the 90s, with the sort of arms coming up to the armpits almost. It looks very uncomfortable. Not everybody would be physically capable of doing it, I don't think, but it doesn't look safe. The bike doesn't look stable like that. There's going to be an accident at some point.
I mean, if I had to descend like that, sitting on the top tube, I will probably die quite soon.
on that light breezy note.
Oh my goodness.
Also on Mohoric, Rich, that reminds me, tonight I called Adam Yates Saddam, because I was halfway through calling him Simon, and then I corrected myself, so then I called him Saddam. he found that quite funny, fortunately. I promise I will henceforth refer to him as Saddam Hussein. Anyway, Mohoric is also a very clever, articulate chap, as you mentioned. And in fact, it was something I heard quite regularly or on numerous occasions in the first couple of years when he was a professional, that he wasn't going to cut it as a pro rider because he was too smart.
Too smart. I think our source might be the same for that little anecdote. But yeah, he was almost too thoughtful, too intelligent, too much of a thinker. I'm not sure. I mean, I think he, as you say, is still only 22. And he showed today great talent, what he's capable of. I'm not sure what sort of rider he's going to become, but it takes some riders longer than others to develop.
And it's an interesting career path that, he did do 1 year as an under 23, but turning pro when he was 18, not too many guys have done that over the last few years. Our friend Pippo Possato was a sort of test case in Italian cycling.
Look how that turned out.
And that was a very controversial precedent that he set by skipping the under 23 category completely and going from juniors to pros. And that was criticised at the time. And, you know, some people did say that damaged Possato. And, you know, he's never really recovered from that, as he sort of suns himself on a beach in Ibiza. But, Mohoric has taken a few years to come to the boil, and you know, you do wonder whether he perhaps should have spent a year or two longer as an under 23. Maybe ultimately won't matter now. He seems to be on the right track, but I don't think it's for everyone, that is it? And we've talked about this before, and we talk about it quite regularly. Pro racing simply doesn't suit some outstanding amateurs. They come in and no one really can predict that. You know, you look at the talent they have, you can look at the sort of numbers they put out in a lab, and you think they might be perfect for it, but they simply don't adapt to the style of racing.
I think the problem with a guy like that, such a prodigious talent, winning junior and then under 23 titles, to then become accustomed to not winning, to not being one of the best, is a very hard adjustment. And it's a credit to him that he has stuck with it for 4 years, in the sense that he's obviously exercised some patience and he's not lost his head. I've spoken to him, I think I spoke to him at the Giro last year, and he rode the Tour either last year or the year before in the Giro, one of the years, and I spoke to him at both, and I was struck again by how level-headed he seemed, despite the fact that the results weren't coming yet. And now that he's got this, who knows what he might go on to achieve. Another man of the day was Paweł Pojanski, as he was yesterday, the Bora Hansgrohe rider, Polish rider, who tweeted a picture of his legs on the eve of the race, didn't he, and alarmed some people with the veininess. He was at the Tour de France, yeah, with the veininess of his legs. Was it? God, time is just sort of concertinaed for me. But anyway, he was second yesterday, second again today. He's obviously in great shape. I shamelessly mentioned to him that, of course, yesterday saw Polish 1-2, as we'd seen a few weeks earlier in Marseille, as if I'd sort of realised that all along, when obviously I had to be corrected for that last night. But anyway, here he is at the finish after yet another second place.
I try, for sure, but I think so now I need to some days rest, like tomorrow and Monday we have rest day, and I'm ready for second and last week for sure in this Vuelta.
You're obviously in really good shape.
Yeah, from beginning of it, I have had some stomach problems, but day by day I start to feel better, and I have in mind this victory also from this morning. I go to Breakaway only for win the stage, because second and third place is not interest me, but yeah, today Moritz is going really fast, but the Vuelta is still long, and day by day I start to feel better.
I mean, we're commenting on the Polish 1-2 on the stage yesterday. A few weeks ago we had a Polish 1-2 in Marseille in the time trial at Tour de France. There seem to be an awful lot of very good Polish riders at the moment.
Yeah, we have Rafał Majka, we have Kwiatkowski, and I think so the Polish race is coming more but strong, and the season, okay, is maybe not so long, but we have also a championship, and I think so Kwiatkowski or Rafa can win this race, and yeah, we look forward, but Polish riders is coming day, but year coming stronger, and I'm happy about this.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks to Science of Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. You can get 20% off at scienceofsport.com if you enter the code CPAUG20, CPAUG20, for all your sports nutrition. Now, in this part, Daniel's had to rush off, but he'll join us again at the end. But you spoke a couple of days ago, I mentioned this already, to Jesse Ball, who... Of all the riders, I mean, he has been a bit of a breakaway specialist this Vuelta, but he went very close to taking the overall lead today.
Yeah, hold on. Aren't you the Jetse Ball specialist? Weren't you the guy who wrote a book on Jetse Ball?
No.
No? Oh, okay, Usain Bolt. Okay.
Sorry. Oh my God, Fran, have you been rehearsing that? That's terrible.
Yeah. I have been thinking of that for the whole day.
Oh, that's awful. Oh, my God. Anyway, he went very, very close, and you were standing with him at the finish as he finished the stage, yeah. And then obviously waited to see whether he would have the red jersey, and it was about 40, I think he's about 46 seconds.
Yeah, 40 seconds shy of getting it, you know. He was actually quite anxious. You could tell, because he wasn't talking to anyone. Even if there were some journals with his mics on his mouth, he won't open it. He was just looking at the clock, staring as the muscles and the general manager of the team were counting as the clock ticked. Unfortunately, he couldn't make it, and as soon as he realized that he wasn't bound to be the red jersey of the Vuelta, he just jumped on his bike and left. You know, even if the teammates and the team members tried to crack some jokes on him in order to cheer him up, he just ignored them and went straight to the bus.
It would have been quite a story had Manzana Postobon taken the red jersey, the smallest team in the race, by some distance. I mean, their team bus is literally like a school bus that's just been painted in the team colours. Nothing fancy about that whatsoever. They'll certainly have the smallest budget in the race by some distance. We want to do a little feature on the team, actually find out a bit more about the team. And Fran is our man to do that over the next few days. But as I said, you did speak to Jesse Ball, and let's hear his story. How did a Dutchman end up on a small Colombian team? Here he is.
Yeah. My manager is Spanish, and he had good contacts with the team already last year. And they were looking for European riders with experience that also speak a little Spanish. So, yeah, it's the way how I ended up here. My wife is Mexican and I live in Girona, so 1-on-1 is 2. And that made it a good situation for me. I met her in Mexico, and there are a lot of Mexicans in Mexico. No, I did Vuelta Chihuahua in 2009, and afterwards I did Criterium in Cancun. And by that time she was also a cyclist, and it was a woman's race, and I met her, and I fell in love. Romantic.
Great.
Yeah.
I think your career has been, catches the eye, how you have went down from the World Tour.
Yeah.
Up to the continental level, now up to pro continental again. What did you just seek in the World Tour at the first place? What did happen?
I think I just needed some more times to find out how everything worked. Afterwards, maybe I haven't gave it all on that level, but that was more because I didn't know how to give it all. You get wiser by the years, let's say that way. And apparently, I needed some more time to find a way to perform the best. I'm happy I can show it now.
Great. I see you quite slim, and I thought that you were a bulkier rider, yeah, more experienced suit. How come? Have you developed a new talent as a climber?
Yeah, well, that's also maybe a reason why I'm performing way better now, is because I dropped some kilos. And that took me some time as well to find a way to be the best rider I can be. And yeah, well, I focused this year more as ever on it to drop some weight, because I know with this team I will do a more Southern European program, while I was normally more used to do a Northern European program, or Belgium, Holland, Northern France kind of racing. So I knew it would be in my own favor to be a little lighter, and I worked hard on it, and I'm happy I've done that.
Yeah, you know, and after all, coming to a Colombian team, it makes more or less sense to become a climber, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. Not really what they expected from me when they signed me, I think, but they are happy with the way I evolved.
So there we are, Yetsibol. I mean, quite an odd story, but, you know, this is his shot window, isn't it? This is his chance to maybe catch the eye of one of the bigger teams and get back into World Tour.
Yeah, you know, actually, well, he had spent some years on Bakansuay and then climbed down to the team, the Chica Cycling Team, the Richke, a continental outfit. And he was going to net a post in the Rompot Orange team by winning the top competition, which is an amateur challenge composed by, I don't know, 10 or so race in Holland. But when he was going to actually win the competition and get that contract, he decided to give it away to a teammate on the last race.
Listen to Kilometer Zero, our morning show at the Vuelta a España, by becoming a friend of the Cycling Podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com.
It doesn't really exist in any other sports, does it?
Well, I broke my derailleur somewhere, and I just remember everybody was gone. I was like, now what? But then you find so many fans, and I just gave a pair of gloves to a guy, and he just brought me to the finish in his own car.
I definitely remember there were some cookies in the Liège broom wagon, and we were all just crushing the cookies and everything else we could find.
Seems like kind of a depressing place to be.
Well, normally we don't say so much. You just think about what went wrong while you're sitting in the bus, and just hoping to get to the finish line and to go home.
And every day they call me, hey, come inside, but no.
I think it's the really last option to go into the broom wagon.
The broom wagon is the vehicle that lurks on the shoulder of the last man on the road, ready to sweep up any stragglers who can't go on. No one wants to finish their day by climbing on board and riding to the finish in silence, but sometimes it's the only option. Nowadays, the broom wagon at the Grand Tours is more symbolic than practical, because it really is a last resort for the riders.
We heard there a little advert, basically, for Kilometer Zero, which is available at the Vuelta to friends of the podcast. Become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. Today was our third at the Broom Wagon, speaking to a few riders about the Broom Wagon, stories from the Broom Wagon, etc. I did enjoy Steph Clement's story about being in a Broom Wagon with Christian Moreni. But that was released Friday, and on Wednesday it was Lucho, story of Luis Herrera, the Colombian who won the Vuelta a España in 1987, first Colombian to win a Grand Tour. And on Monday we did a feature on Aqua Blue Sport making their debut here. Six more episodes still to come, so do sign up to become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. Now, there was another little thing of interest that happened today. I mentioned it already, Fran, but something else happened today, Fran. Unfortunately, an incident involving Rafael Reiss, the Cajarroal rider who was in that breakaway. He was hit by a motorbike. It's happened a few times on the Vuelta. You went and spoke to him at the finish. I think his response to that will surprise some people, but here's what he had to say.
What a nice day on the breakaway, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a really hard day. It's really hard to catch the breakaway. In the start of the race, we're going really, really fast, and finally I can catch the breakaway, and I'm really happy with that. But yeah, so it was a really hard day, the hot weather, and the rhythm, it was fast.
Yeah.
But yeah, in the final climb, I was bad luck with motorbikes, but it stings from the race. And well,
what happened there with the motorbike?
Yeah, I go on the left side in the it was cobbles.
Yeah.
I go in the left side with
the edge of the road where there are not cobbles.
That part finish, and I go to the right side to catch the good road, and a motorbike kicked me out.
Had this ever happened to you
on
another race?
No. This is the first time. Well, sometimes the motorbikes going really well. I don't know, fast, but. Yeah. To pass the guys, but today bad luck, that's it.
Yeah,
the things from the race, and bad luck.
But why did this thing happen on the Vuelta especially? Because it seems like there has been a string of accidents in the Vuelta España related to motorbikes.
I don't know what that's things. The things passed, and I don't know. There are humans, we are humans, and we do mistakes, and that's it.
After all, the point that Rafael Reis make is that this is an incident, just a race incident. You know, it's quite unfortunate that this has happened so many times at the Vuelta a España, but at the same time, you know, whoever who covers cycling races can see that these kind of incident, or at least close calls, are quite common between cars, motorbikes and cyclists.
I mean, I thought it was very, very gracious of him to say what he said and to not be more annoyed about it and to not blame the motorcycle pilot. As you say, we have seen a few incidents like that at the Vuelta over the years, and this week I think there have appeared to be quite a lot of motorbikes getting in the way, especially Thursday on that narrow road and the narrow climb and descent where guys were coming back from the breakaway, the bunch led by Contador was going very fast, and nobody wants to see that. And I don't know if it's worse here at the Vuelta or not, but it is an issue. It can have tragic consequences. So, you know, it's great to hear him be very magnanimous and gracious and forgiving of the incident, but it's not a nice thing to see.
But how can we address that issue? You know, how can we address this issue? You know, how can we solve this problem with cars, motorbikes and bicycles sharing the space of a road race? Because after all, cyclists are of course focused on competition, but as they are, all of them are focusing on doing their job as good as possible. And, you know, it's almost unavoidable for some kind of accidents happening. The only thing one can do is to have the most skilled people possible driving the motorbikes, driving the cars and driving the bikes, so to avoid things. But other than that, what would you suggest to improve the current situation?
Fewer motorbikes, fewer vehicles. I mean, a radical suggestion from a sports director I've heard is to get rid of the convoy and to only have neutral service behind the race. Because traditionally, sports directors have sat in cars and followed the race. It's very difficult to do that now. They'd actually be better following the race on television in team buses and so on. Having been in the convoy, it's a miracle to me that more accidents don't happen behind the race rather than at the front of the race. I mean, we see the near misses and the sometimes the sort of the crowded nature of the roads when the motorbikes and the bikes all get a bit too close at the front. We don't see what happens at the back, and believe me, it's worse back there. But I think there are often too many vehicles, too many motorbikes, too many cars.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast. I mentioned Pedler de Charme earlier. Larry Warbass, a very convincing winner of that Head of Mojave Kudus. Unfortunately, both crashed out today. But Larry does win Pedler de Charme. I mentioned that the T-shirt is winging its way to him. And if you want to own a Pedler de Charme T-shirt, go to rafa.cc or go to the shop at thecyclingpodcast.com. Now, We're going to hear from a couple of riders who are struggling in this part. Jelle Wallis from Lotto Soudal, who I spoke to at the start today. He finished well down again today, but he's had a couple of terrible crashes. One of them, there's a clip of one of them where a bidon just appears from nowhere and it catches his front wheel and he goes down like a sack of cement. I mean, it looked very, very painful. I was watching him at the start. He could barely move. He was very stiff, but he posed for lots of photos, signed lots of autographs, and seemed to be very kind of in very good spirits, which was impressive. Spoke to him at the start, spoke to Conor Dunn at the finish, Aqua Blue rider who lost his teammate and captain, Larry Warbass, today. And both of them, it's fair to say, are struggling. Let's hear from them now. It just gives another perspective on the race, almost a week in. First, Jelle Wallis, and then Conor Dunn.
I have very much pain, but I want to arrive in Madrid. But yesterday it was a hell because of the racing very hard. But I survived, and now today I will see how it happens, and hopefully I survive again.
Are you sleeping okay?
Yeah, the sleep is okay, but on the bike I can accelerate, I can... everything is on the saddle, and that's the most problem. If the peloton accelerate, I need to do my own tempo, and I hope I come back. And
so you can't get out of the saddle. You're moving very stiffly off the bike as well. Do you feel more comfortable on the bike?
Yeah, but I have bruised ribs. I have a bruised wrist, and also my ankle is bruised, and that's the problem on the bike. But sitting and a good tempo, it's okay, but the acceleration is too much.
Your crash of the day, have you seen the video footage? There's a bottle. You hit a bottle, didn't you?
Yeah, the bottle comes into my front wheel and I crashed.
Very heavily.
And the day before, I crashed at 3K to go, also heavily. From the bottle is the left side of my body, all open, and the bruised things are from the first crash.
Amazingly, you're still smiling and you're giving photographs and autographs there. You seem to be still in good spirits.
Yeah, of course. I had a good condition, and I want to be in a break week, and I make it to the last week, and then we see. I hope I make it to the first rest day, and then my body can recover more, and we will see then.
A disappointing day for the team, Larry. Going, where were you when the crash happened? Were you aware of it?
Yeah, I was actually like 20 wheels back. It was a really fast moment because we came onto this fast road in a crosswind, and everyone was like sprinting for the wheels, and then I saw a big crash ahead, and I was far enough back to avoid it. But then when I came around, Larry was on the floor looking pretty bad, to be honest. He looked pretty dazed. So immediately I thought that was a bad one, you know. So I felt really sorry for him. And then we heard he wasn't back in the convoy, and then we heard he was out. So pretty gutting for us, because he's kind of our big rider in the mountains, and one of the more experienced riders on the team. So, and he's also a real great guy. We were hoping he'd do well. Really gutted for him.
Amazing how quickly things changed. Yesterday he was up there in the break, and today he's out of the race.
Yeah, it's just how savage the sport is, really. It's like... kind of everything has to go right for it to go right.
How are you almost a week into your first Grand Tour?
Okay. It was a super hard day for me yesterday. I was like on a bit of a bad day, and then it was just a super hard pace. So I was just suffering a lot at the back, just holding on, and I was just doing everything I could to survive that day, and got through okay in Gruppetto, so I was proud of that, but took a lot of mental strength.
Are days like that harder? Because everybody knows about the big mountain days, but days like yesterday seem to catch a lot of people out. Are they mentally especially even harder?
Yeah, I think yesterday it was just so hard because we were like other guys at the back just suffering on the climbers. We'd be at the back, and then on the descents it was super hard. So I was doing like a lot of my max sprints on the descents, just getting out of corners and things, and it's just relentless, just never ending. And I think it looks easy on the TV, but that was one of the hardest days I've had yesterday.
And was today a little bit better?
Yeah, like I had a bit of a bad moment this morning before the stage. Yesterday I had to dig so deep. I was like, I really didn't know if I could do it again in my head. And luckily, I've got some good teammates giving me some wise words, and just got on with it. And the legs are actually okay, and I got through it okay. Did what I could, saved energy, ate a lot of food, and got through it okay. So the body's okay. Just keeping the mind strong is the toughest bit. But the fight goes on.
So we heard from two riders there who are struggling. I think this is a particularly hard moment in the race, if you like, almost a week in, still waiting for the first rest day. And I think yesterday's stage, Thursday's stage, it caught a lot of people by surprise, just the brutality of it.
Yeah, it's been quite a hard week, you know, and I can only feel for a guy that has also suffered a crash on the very first minutes of the race, who was Jorge Arcas for Movistar team. He crashed hard on the team time trial in Nîmes, and he is walking like a robot. And when you try to talk to him and make a conversation, he can only say, "It hurts. I can move my back. I can see. I can watch the right side, wherever." And I can only feel empathy, and I can only feel bad for him.
No, I think it has been a very hard first week, Fran. You know, we were just talking before the podcast as well about this sort of trend, this vogue for a lack of time trialing, or lack of, you know, just one individual time trial in this race. So that, for a lot of guys, that effectively cuts down their resting time, because they do treat individual time trials particularly as almost as rest days. Where, and, you know, if they look at the road book for this race, they can turn over page after page after page, and all they'll see are days when it could possibly be very hard, and it's going to be very aggressive racing. And, you know, there are so many inexperienced riders in this race, so many first timers, so many young riders, 60 odd, under 25 or under. So, yeah, I'm sure there are a lot among them who are really suffering. And it's a long old road to Madrid, isn't it?
It is. Now, Daniel, were you going to give us a little glimpse into tomorrow's stage?
Well, tomorrow we've got it's perhaps too much to say it's a legendary finish for the Vuelta, but it's certainly become pretty well known in the last 15 years. Fran, I will go to you for the perfect pronunciation. It's the Choret de Cati, del Cati.
Yeah. Choret del Cati.
Del Cati. Yeah. And it's a very, very steep climb, typical Vuelta climb. I think it's about 2 kilometres. I did it a couple of years ago three or four years ago on a folding bike, actually.
And actually, humble brag alert.
Managed to get up. Typical Vuelta climb. You know, pitches, slopes of up to about 18-19%, and it's going to be spectacular. This climb is very much linked to the legend of Chava Jimenez, one of the great climbers the last 20 odd years in the Vuelta. And in fact, there's a statue commemorating, is it one or two of his victories, just beyond the summit. Chava Jimenez was a regular winner of stages in the Vuelta, protagonist in a great battle with Abraham Olano in 1998.
Yes.
When their respective wives got involved, and it got very messy.
Imagine if Twitter had existed back then.
Well, it was very, very reminiscent of all the 2012 Tour de France, with the, you know, a slight sort of social media fisticuffs between Kath Wiggins and Michelle Froome, where, well, you know, they were slightly upset with each other, weren't they? That was reminiscent of Chava Jimenez's wife and Abraham Alano's wife in 1998 at the Vuelta. I think one of them, I think it was Alano's wife, had a slot on the radio, on national radio, and she was using that every day as a platform to sound off.
Exactly. It was mostly a story built because there was so much radio coverage in the Vuelta a España in the late 90s. There was kind of a war between the main Spanish stations in order to get the best possible coverage of the Vuelta a España. And that led to a lot of talk shows being centered on the race, and the pressure, especially on Abraham Olano's wife, was immense during those final weeks, those two final weeks of the Vuelta a España, because Chava Jimenez was a more popular rider. He was a climber, attacking guy, irregular, a genius.
Jimenez,
so to speak.
Jimenez had Pedler de Charme, cycling podcast existed at the time, he would have been a shoe-in, I think, for Pedler de Charme.
I was reminded of a great story I once heard about Chava Jimenez the other day when we were in Andorra, and I'm not sure if this is 100% true. It's probably one of those great cycling stories that's been slightly embellished, but I remember a Spanish colleague telling me that in one edition of the Volta a Catalunya, he showed up to the start one day in Andorra. There was a stage starting in Andorra, and the team, it probably wasn't a team bus back then, the team vehicles parked up, Xavi Jimena disappeared, much in the same way that we saw Pippo Pozzato disappear into the west end of London at the Tour of Britain a couple of years ago and come back with Dolce & Gabbana bags and so forth. But Xavi Jimena went much further than that. He disappeared for half an hour and he came back with the keys to a Ferrari.
Oh, that typical Chava, you know, yeah. as far as I can tell, yeah.
A terrible postscript, though, to the Jimenez story. He died just months before Marco Pantani. Was it end of 2003?
December 2003.
Yeah, in not dissimilar circumstances. So, you know, one of the tragic stories of modern cycling. But we should wrap things up for tonight, chap. Sorry to end it on a sort of downbeat note like that. But we
big
should...
Big old transfer, isn't it?
We've got a long
we're
drive.
Basically going back to where we started.
We've got a long drive now, 2.5 hours, I think. So that's all for tonight. Thank you very much, Fran.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.